The following presentation is a Vintage Quixotic production.
Jungle Natives, the all-new, unofficial Guns N' Roses podcast.
Then when she said she's going to wreck my car, I know what to do.
Here's your hosts, Brooke Ellis and Christina Rice.
Hello, I'm Brooke Ellis, and this is Jungle Natives, the all-new, unofficial Guns N' Roses podcast. And to my right is the lovely and talented Christina Rice.
Hi there.
Hi, Christina. Now, what's crazy is this is actually the first time you and I have had a substantial meeting in over 20 years. Our friendship was solely based on this mutual love of Guns N' Roses. And do you remember the first time we met?
I do remember the first time we met. It was, I think it was sometime in 1992, and I was working at a grocery store at the time, bagging groceries, and somebody came in and told me Tower Records had some import magazine with Guns N' Roses on the cover, and I was obsessed with Guns N' Roses. They were my life. Every last dime I made, I spent on them, and so as soon as my shift was over, I grabbed one of my coworkers and ran down to Tower Records in West Covina looking for this I don't think it was Kerrang. I don't remember what magazine it was.
Raw, maybe? Raw?
It might have been Raw. Was that British?
Yes.
Okay, it might have been Raw. And so I ran into Tower Records looking for this magazine, and you worked there. And so I ran into you and said, I'm looking for this magazine with Guns N' Roses on the cover. And those were the magic words, Guns N' Roses.
Right, and that's actually the missing piece to my puzzle, the way I remember it.
Okay.
Because you came in with your friend. I remember you had a flannel shirt, and I think you had like a bandana on your wrist or something. I knew you were a rocker. And I didn't remember what you were looking for specifically, but I knew it was Guns N' Roses. We didn't have it, but I told you, the new issue of Rip Magazine has Axl on the cover, and it was the first part of the three-part interview with Del James, the I Axl interview. And I remember I put it in your hand, and I didn't know it at the time, but you were like the big Slash fan. I was the big Axl fan, and I remember, I don't even think you bought it. I think you were kind of in between, well, I'm not really big on Axl.
No, now that you mentioned it, I'd forgotten about that. No, I think it had just hit the newsstand that day, or you guys put it out a day early. No, now I...
That's right. I got it for you. That's right.
You went and got it from the back.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, I thought, was I allowed to buy it? I don't think I could buy it. I think you could just show it to me.
I'll tell you what, the only time I've done that before was in 1989 when I worked in a record store in New Jersey for Charles Barkley, the basketball player. I gave him Fear of a Black Planet by Public Enemy a day or two before it came out. So you're in good company.
It's me and Charles Barkley. Awesome.
Yeah. So anyway, here we are 20 years later, and we're talking about Guns N' Roses again. Obviously, we went on to have some misadventures throughout the 90s, and we could get to those stories in future episodes, and there's some good ones. But let's talk about what you've been up to since, because literally I haven't seen you in 22 years.
Do you remember that I actually saw you at the midnight showing of Attack of the Clones?
I do remember that, okay. And I was surprised that you recognized me.
See, I got the impression you didn't recognize me. Like, oh, he doesn't remember who I am.
No, because we did talk briefly.
Did we?
But for the sake of the podcast, this is really...
About Guns.
But no, what I mean is this is really... We haven't seen each other in over 20 years.
No, we have not. We have not. So in 20 years, gosh, I guess you could say I've become incredibly domesticated. I'm married now. I have a 4-year-old daughter. I got my bachelor's in film, a master's in library science. I'm a librarian. I'm now a published author. I wrote a book about 1930s, 40s star Anne Dvorak. Well, maybe not a star, but actress Anne Dvorak. And I am currently writing My Little Pony comic books.
Which is amazing. Now, do you have a big listenership of bronies?
I've only had 2 issues come out, so slowly building. So I've done some signings, and bronies do show up.
But how creepy is that?
So far, they've been okay.
Okay,
they,
cool.
They have, yeah. So far, it's not met my expectations.
Well, I gotta say, I'm impressed. I mean, you wrote this book about this old Hollywood actress, and you're writing a comic book. That's pretty darn cool. I never would have expected that when you're working at Albertsons in 1997. So congratulations.
Thank you. And it was Ralph's.
Oh, Ralph's. Okay. So anyway, some of the old-timer listeners may remember me as Steven Adler's webmaster. I ran his webpage from 2000 to 2008. I co-wrote, or maybe I should say I ghostwrote his book, My Appetite for Destruction, before having an unfortunate falling out with him. But I'm also a rock journalist. I've contributed to various rock magazines, most notably Classic Rock Magazine. I just covered the Slash event that they filmed for TV. I was at the Classic Rock Awards. I just interviewed Duff a month or two ago. So that's what I've been up to in a nutshell. Back to what our listeners are listening for. That's Guns N' Roses. So in 1987, let's go earlier, to the mid-80s, there's this band, Guns N' Roses, in L.A. The funny thing is, none of the guys are actually from Los Angeles. You have W. Axl Rose, that's his legal name. He had it changed from William Bailey. And he grew up in Lafayette, Indiana, in a very religious and strict household. It was the type of environment where if he was watching TV and there happened to be a bikini-clad woman on the screen, his dad would smack him in the head. Axl, or William, didn't do anything, and he didn't know what was going on. He had a younger brother named Stuart, and his first foray into singing was with the Bailey Trio. There were the three kids singing religious tunes. He won a radio in a church contest, and he actually had to keep it hidden from his family, and that was his exposure to rock and roll and contemporary music of the 70s. And when he and his brother would go to the bowling alley or to 7-Eleven or whatever, one of the songs that he often heard was 10cc's I'm Not in Love, and that was ended up being one of his favorite songs for years. So he grew up in this strict environment. The only music he could listen to was Elvis Presley gospel records and Jimmy Swaggart religious records, and he was very sheltered. But when he became a teenager, his parents started accusing him of doing drugs and doing bad things, and he wasn't. But since he was being accused of these things, he figured, well, I'm going to find out what they're all about. So as naturally as teenagers do, he rebelled, grew his hair long, got in trouble with the police. Meanwhile, at his high school in Indiana, he has his buddy, Jeff Isbell, who will later be known as Izzy Stradlin. And the impression that I get from Izzy, since I don't really know him, is that he was just this cool character, very independent, didn't need anybody, kind of quiet, sort of a hipster. And I kind of get the feeling that Axl was more interested in being a part of what he had going on than necessarily vice versa. And as these guys grew up, you know, Axl's hitchhiking across the country. I think he went to New York with a buddy, hitchhiked there. I know at least once he had a bad experience with some guy hitting on him and he had to threaten him. And at one point, Izzy hitchhiked to L.A. and Axl decided to follow suit. Ended up in Fullerton, thinking it was the smallest city he ever saw. Took the bus for 2 days, never found Izzy, but they did eventually connect. And at that point, Izzy was into Hanoi Rocks and said, "Hey, Axl, we got to get into this sort of sound and this sort of look. This is where it's at right now." And I guess that would have been like 85 or maybe 84. So that's Izzy and Axl in L.A. Do you want to tell us a little about Slash?
I will tell you a little about Slash. I'm going to preface this with I'm pulling this all from the annals of my memory
exactly.
As a teenager.
And I do want to say, too, because I know a lot of people that post in the forums and stuff, the fans, are waiting for me to slip up because, like, you know, I wrote the book and everything. And like, oh, well, he has no business writing a book about Guns N' Roses. But again, after the debacle with Steven Adler, I still haven't had the heart to put Appetite on my iPod since then. And that was almost 5 years ago. So anyway, go ahead.
That's so sad.
Indeed.
Sorry to hear that. So Slash. So yeah, I'm reaching back into my teenage obsession with Slash. Slash was born July 23rd, 1965 in Stoke-on-Trent, England, to Ola and Anthony Hudson. He was not, shockingly, not born Slash. He was born Saul Hudson.
Steven Adler actually corrected me. It's Saul.
It's Saul?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, that's what he told me anyway.
Oh, well, Anne Dvorak wanted to be called Anne Dvorak, and we call her Anne Dvorak, so we'll go with Saul or Saul Hudson. His father, Anthony, was a graphic designer. I think one of his most notable commissions was the Court and Spark album by Joni Mitchell. His mother was a costume designer, designed David Bowie's costumes for The Man Who Fell to Earth, among others. And Slash's upbringing was the polar opposite of Axl's, whereas Axl's, you know, he was, you know, very strict and very religious. Slash's was much more freewheeling.
Yeah, as Robin Quivers of the Howard Stern Show called it when they interviewed Slash in 95, "You grew up in an orgy." And he practically did. And I think what's interesting is that Slash's mom's a dark-skinned black woman. His dad is a Jewish man. I just think it's really cool that the greatest rock star on the planet is half black and half Jewish. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Which also makes One in a Million that much more of a mystery in retrospect.
Right. Slash's mom was upset about it, but Slash wasn't. You know, he understood what it was for, but that's a future.
He rolled with it. So anyway, so Slash came to the United States at age 11, came to Los Angeles, and very much grew up in that kind of hippie, freewheeling, you know, musical, free love lifestyle. You know, was a music fan from a very young age. And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, got turned on to actually playing guitar by Steven Adler.
That's right.
Yeah, Stephen was the one. So Slash, as a teenager, I think didn't go to school a lot, and he rode bicycle, like trick bike riding. And one day he was out trick bike riding with a bunch of friends, and some kid on a skateboard goes by and flies off and lands on his head. And
right, that was at Steve actually took me to that school.
Did he really?
It's an elementary school or a middle school, and it goes. It should be mentioned that Mark Cantor, one of Slash's buddies, said that Slash was one of the best BMX bikers around at that time. Yeah, and then Steve wiped out on a skateboard, and Slash was like, oh man, that guy's got to be wounded.
Yeah.
And that's how they sort of met.
That's exactly how Slash would describe that. This guy's got to be wounded. Yeah, and then they became friends, and at one point they went to Steven's house, and he had a guitar and plugged in and put on a Kiss record.
Right.
Does that sound?
Yeah, and basically he didn't know how to play. I think Steven's grandmother got him the guitar. Yeah. Maybe it might have been his aunt. But he just showed him his Ace Frehley moves, and Slash ended up taking to the guitar more. Steve's like, sure, take it. And that's when he began playing drums.
And then Slash picked up the guitar, and the rest is history.
The rest is history, yeah.
Absolutely.
And I want to talk about Steven Adler a little bit. He was born in Cleveland. His real name is Michael Coletti. His dad was an Italian gangster wannabe who basically beat Steven's mom. When he was 2 years old, he left them, and she remarried Melvin Adler, and that's when he was rechristened Steven Adler. And they moved, from Cleveland to L.A., but Steven never got along with his family. He was a wild kid. He was out of control, so you got to have a little sympathy for his parents, you know, stepdad and his mom, because he was a wild kid. And it got to the point when he was 12 or 13, his stepdad said, look, it's either him or me. And she said, Steve, you got to go. But fortunately for him, his grandparents lived nearby, and they loved him to death. His grandmother, Big Lily, his grandfather, Storm and Norman, they would do anything for him. So he ended up living with them, and that's how he had the freedom to just be who he was. And it got him into some hairy predicaments, as you may have read in the book. And by the way, those very personal items, you know, were told to me after months of, you know, hanging out and working on the book. So, you know, when he went on like the Howard Stern show and said, yeah, me and Larry Spagnuolo wrote this over lunch or whatever, it was very disappointing. Anyway, so he meets Slash at the school. And not only after he wipes out on a skateboard, but also a teacher chases him out of class one day and into another classroom where a teacher is yelling at Slash. So these guys knew they were meant to be buddies. So they become great friends, blood brothers even, where they, you know, they prick their fingers and bond their blood and say that they're going to be blood brothers. So then we got Duff, the youngest of a gang of children, basically given free rein to do whatever he wants because he's, you know, the beloved youngest child. And I get the feeling from Duff that he was just a likable guy from the start. I don't think he really faced much animosity. Doesn't he seem like the type that everybody just sort of, oh, you're cool, and welcomes him with open arms? Or
absolutely. I think, and he is cool. Like, I, yeah, you know, I met him when I was a teenager. He was awesome. Like, he's just, you know, he's Duff. He's just a cool guy. So, who has issue with him?
Right. Now, I met him a few times early on. There was a period in GNR's heyday where, you know, he was drinking heavily, and he could be a dick. But it was all part of the rock star thing, you know what I mean? And the very first time I met him, he was kind of a dick. And that's something I might get into later, but I've met him since, and he was super.
Well, I will say, I met Slash and Duff on the same day when I was 17. It was about a week before The Illusions came out. Slash, not so great. And a couple hours later, I met Duff at a different location, and he was lovely. He was drunk, but he was lovely.
Well, where did you meet Duff?
Do you remember Pirate Radio?
Of course.
So Slash was doing an interview at KNAC. It was right when senior year of high school started. I ditched class and went out and hung out at KNAC all day from like 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, met Slash, and then ran over to Pirate Radio. And I don't even remember. They were in some high rise. So we get, and this is like a week before The Illusions come out. So Guns N' Roses is at the height of their popularity. Yeah, so I went down to the radio station with a couple of friends, and there were 12 people waiting. So considering this was, they were the biggest band in the world, I think people realized he was going there, or they just weren't taking the time. And so I think a lot of people were waiting out in front of KNAC, and me and my friends were waiting in the garage, the back door, and that's where Slash's limousine pulled up. And so, he came out and he just was zipped into the radio station, and I ran and stopped him. And he is, it sounds hokey. He was my God. Like, he really was.
I could vouch for that.
Yeah. And I did run up to him and I stopped him and said, Slash, could I please get a picture? I think he turned around and said, I'm really busy right now, and walked away. And it was, kind of, oh.
That must have been heartbreaking.
It was heartbreaking.
More than just, it must have been, was it profound?
It was.
Because you're only 16 or 17.
I'm 17. It was very hard. And so I kind of turn around and the sad Peanut song is playing in my head. and I went up to my friends and I'm like, oh man, he wasn't that nice. And then a guy runs out, and I don't know I think it was part of the radio station or part of his entourage, and he comes out and he says, if you just stay here, Slash will come out and sign autographs. So like instant redemption. And so everybody, the other, 9 people figured out that he had entered the studio. And so we all just hung out waiting for him to come out. When he finally comes out, again, there's just 12 of us. He comes out, he sees us all standing there. We're all very anxious. He sees us, rolls his eyes and goes, fuck. Which, he's like 26 years old and top of the world. And we all kind of giggle nervously. So to his credit, he signed everything and he took pictures with all of us. But he did make it seem like, we were pulling teeth a little bit.
Very interesting.
And then I had gone and that morning bought Sharpies. I had bought fresh Sharpies just for the occasion, but I hadn't started the Sharpies. And so when he went to sign the autograph, the pen didn't work. And he
goes, oh, no.
And he goes, man, you guys and your fucking pens. And I'm just like, well, it's brand new. So he finally got it working and he signed a bunch of autographs and then holds the pen up and goes, here, it's somebody's brand new pen. So, but to his credit, he did stick around long enough.
A little bit of insult to injury there, though.
Exactly. So we finish up with Slash.
But then again, to be fair to these guys, they don't know, how important it is to somebody like you. They don't know which fan is the one that really takes it to heart. And again, they're just young punks,
They're young punks. Yeah. Like, they're the biggest band in the world. Like, how do you process that at that age? So, no, in retrospect, it's fine. I don't hold it against Slash at all. And then as soon as we finished with Slash, we got in the car and hauled over to Pirate Radio, which I couldn't even tell you where it was. It was in a high rise somewhere. Maybe it was downtown. I have no idea.
Right. And for the listeners, that was an old sort of a KNAC style radio station that played Guns N' Roses. And then the day that they played Green Day in 92 and Rage Against the Machine, it was all over.
Yeah, I have to say, but they're kind of like the uncool KNAC because they would play heavily edited versions of Paradise City.
Okay.
Yeah, they played the 3-minute version of Paradise City.
I didn't know there was a 3-minute version.
For Pirate Radio, there was.
And I'll tell you something, because at the job that I have currently, they surf through radio stations. I think radio stations, like you said, Pirate Radio, do their own edits. I've heard 3 different edits of November Rain that I've never heard before. 2 different edits of Sweet Child of Mine. And again, these are just various random radio stations recently. There's a version of Sweet Child of Mine that completely cuts out Slash's guitar solos.
I heard that on K-Earth 101, which is the oldie station. That is the worst version of Sweet Child of Mine I have ever. And I've heard edited versions in my life. And you're right, that K-Earth one is the worst.
So anyway, you find Duff.
Yeah, so to Pirate Radio's credit, though, they have Duff. And so we go, and it's just, you know, it's in this high-rise building, so it's just this unassuming, you know, office. And me and my friends get up there, and there's two other fans waiting for Duff. So again, like, biggest fan in the world, there's five of us. And so we're all just sitting on the ground outside the door of Pirate Radio, and out comes Duff. And in a couple, he's with a couple of guys, and he walks out, and he's walking towards the elevator. And, you know, and I'm a little bit gun shy now after the experience with Slash a couple hours before. And so we go, "Hey, Duff." And he turns around and looks genuinely surprised to see five kids waiting for him. And he goes, "Well, are you guys waiting here for me?" And we're like, "Yeah. Oh my gosh." And just, he was just lovely. And, you know, and I was just giddy. And, you know, I brought artwork that I had made of the band, which I haven't probably looked at in 20 years. And I'm sure is god awful. But he looked at it and he goes, "Oh my God, did you do that? That's great." And, you know,
it's the antithesis of the Slash experience.
It really was. I mean, he was so sweet. I got stupid. I asked for a hug. I got really stupid. But he was so lovely.
Did you consider jumping ship from Slash fan to Duff fan at that point?
No, I was still always loyal to Slash no matter what. This is so silly. I actually was a Duff fan to begin with, and then he got married. I was 12 at the time, so give me a pass. And so I was fully rooted in Slash.
And by the way, one of the reasons that I thought this podcast with you and I would be of interest is because when Appetite came out, you were 12 years old?
I was 13.
13. When Appetite came out, I was 18. So we have totally different points of view. You're the young kid, you know, enamored with Slash. I've already got long hair. I've already played in the band. In fact, literally months before Appetite came out, I won like a battle of the bands at my high school. And I was already smoking pot, you know, and doing drugs. So I was like the stoner dude. I was like, yeah, Guns N' Roses, you know. And so we have this cool dichotomy of different points of view in regards to what Appetite meant to us. So anyway, getting back on topic.
Oh, but let me finish my Duff story.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's not over. So he goes and gets in the elevator with his entourage. You know, I think he had two people with him. And so we all just let him go. And we're waiting for the elevator door to close and to let Duff go. And he goes, "Well, why don't you guys just get in the elevator? We're all going down." We're like, "What?" So we get in the elevator, and I brought a stack of magazines with me for them to sign. And for some reason, I had a Metal Edge with me. And I don't know if you remember, Metal Edge had these collagey covers.
Oh, yeah.
So there's, you know, so I had him sign a Music Connection from 1986, and I think I had a Rolling Stone with me. Like, I had, like, really cool magazines. And he looks down at this Metal Edge, which has this tiny picture of him, and he looks down and goes, "Is that me?" And I hold it up. Yeah. And he shows it to his friend. "Oh my God, that's me." Like, he was shocked that he was on the cover of this little picture of him on the cover of Metal Edge. So Duff is awesome.
Yeah. And what surprised me getting to know Steven Adler, and I even got to know Slash a little bit, and that'll be in the future. I mean, I don't know if he would remember me or whatever, but what's surprising is these guys were just living their lives. They were oblivious to all the, I mean, I don't want to say that they were totally naive, but they weren't really hip to everything that was going on as far as the hype of Guns N' Roses. I mean, they were surprised when their album hit number one and they were on tour. Like, really? So I find that really interesting because these are down-to-earth kids who, you know, just hit the lottery, the rock and roll lottery. So these five guys are in L.A., Slash and Steven. Their first little band is called Road Crew. It doesn't really go anywhere. But eventually, they end up hooking up with Duff. And by all accounts, Duff was sort of very mod, sort of new wave looking. And they really liked him. And I think they may even have something going for a short while. But these guys are in and out of different variations of bands. In fact, Steven's the first to jam with Axl. And Slash isn't even there. And I don't think Izzy's there either, or some other guitar player. And they do Shadow of Your Love. At least that's what he told me. And so they're going through the motions of the L.A. scene, getting in different formations of bands. And then Axl, Duff, Tracy Guns, Izzy, and a guy named Rob Gardner form the first version of Guns N' Roses. I think that's right. It's been a while since I've, you know, read up on this stuff. And Duff decides to book some shows in Seattle. So using all of his Seattle connections, and by the way, you know, Duff came up in the Seattle scene. He was in punk bands. I think he was even in one notable punk band in Seattle. I want to say 7 Seconds, but I might be wrong. but he has a bit of a history. And he went to the same high school as Nikki Six. Obviously, Nikki had already graduated when Duff was in high school there. So he came to L.A. Now they're in Guns N' Roses. He books this tour of Seattle at like parties and stuff. Well, Tracy and Rob have jobs. Well, you know, I actually spoke to Tracy Guns about this. I said, hey, what happened with this Seattle tour? Why didn't you go? He's like, you know, Rob and I had jobs and we just couldn't. We didn't even know those guys had left. And when they came back, they're like, you're out of the band. So, you know, what happens is, I don't know, Izzy or Axel calls Slash and Steven and says, hey, we've got these shows. Maybe it was Duff that called him. It says, we've got these shows up in Seattle. Do you want to do it? And they're like, hell yeah. So through a comedy of errors and mishaps and setbacks, trying to get out to Seattle because their buddy's car breaks down. This old Mexican guy in a pickup truck tries to give them a ride, but the weight of all five of them won't, you know, the bumper's like grinding against the freeway. So he has to let them out. They hitch a ride on an 18-wheeler. A couple of hippie girls pick them up and give them pot brownies. Finally, they make it to Seattle. They go to Duff's friend's house where Steven said this guy was growing pot in his basement. It was the best pot he ever had. And they have to borrow gear, obviously, because the gear couldn't make it. They didn't have their own vehicle. And they did their few shows, and it was an incredibly bonding experience for the five of them. And that solidified that lineup of Guns N' Roses. So they start playing the LA club scene. And do you want to add anything here about their early days in the club scene?
No, just that I think they were, you know, real ragtag. Didn't they live in a storage unit at one point?
They may have. There was the Hell House. Yeah. And what actually drove by that, and Steve pointed it out to us, was me and his wife, Carolina. I forget the cross streets. But it was just this dumpy old house where there's at any given time, you know, there could be people passed out, pizza boxes all over the place, this real seedy sort of joint, you know, drug deals going on. Cops are always called out, you know, girls, you know, obviously Guns N' Roses never had a problem with the ladies, you know, and the young women would always come by and give them money, give them food. If they're using the bathroom, one of the guys would go through their purse and get like pocket change or whatever. So it was a seedy environment, and they were part of it. But, you know, it was sort of hard for these guys when you consider, you know, Axel's out on his own. You know, he doesn't really have a, you know, he's not with his family in Indiana, neither is Izzy. You know, they're all out there. All they have is each other, you know, and then they have their various friends. Obviously, we can get into that in future episodes, Del James and West Arkeem. But these guys bond. They live in the house. They're playing the clubs. They're playing the whiskey. They play on Tuesday nights. They do well enough to get bumped up to Wednesday, Thursday. Then they're headlining weekends. They're finally headlining weekends for about a year when Vicki Hamilton, or actually Vicki Hamilton may have already been working with them by that point, but she starts getting the labels to come out to see them. She has Elektra come out. Eventually, Tom Zutaut and Brindenthal come out to see them, and he wants to sign the band. And they meet at, I think it's Compadres or Zendejas. It's a Mexican restaurant that's across the street from Guitar Center.
Oh, Los Compadre.
Okay, well, that's where they met.
I had dinner there 2 nights ago.
No way.
I didn't even know, yes.
Are you serious?
I really did.
Well, they took pictures, and then some of the
Compadre.
El Compadre, right.
El Compadre.
And there's pictures of them from that night, you know, drinking margaritas and stuff, and books and stuff. That's where they agreed to sign with Tom Zutaut and Geffen Records. So that brings us up to the release of Appetite. Obviously, we could do a whole episode on the recording of Appetite and stuff, but we just want to sort of give you an idea of what Jungle Natives, this podcast, is about. So we're going to go with this agenda. Appetite is released in, what, July 31st of 87?
Of 87. Well, and I think one of the things that's worth, I don't know if you're going to talk about it, you know, that they're living in these, what some people might consider very questionable environment, questionable circumstances. I certainly could not have survived in that. But that's what produces Appetite. So that's, you know, this disgusting, seedy, however you want to look at it. That's where these songs come from. So
right. And, you know, being a musician at the time, now granted, I'm a few years younger than those guys, obviously. You know, I'm like 7 years younger than Axel, 4 years younger than Steven and Slash. But I was 18 when Appetite came out. I was the target demographic, you know. But what really surprised me was how did they know? And what I mean by that is, at the time, you know, the big bands, Dokken, Metallica, you know, it's all about shredding guitars, you know, finger taps like Eddie Van Halen and, you know, Queensryche, Jeff Tate with the high falsetto scream. This is what's big. This is what I was into. I never would have thought, oh, I want to join a band that's doing an Aerosmith type thing, you know, because that just wasn't what I was into. But then again, that was my generation. When I came up, you know, the first albums that I got were like, you know, Ozzy's first solo albums. And so I missed out on sort of that era, although I obviously caught up with it later. But how did they know to take this? I mean, it wasn't a departure for them, but it was a departure from what was happening on the Sunset Strip. And I think the fact that, you know, they had all these friends really is what made it possible for them to get big early on. I mean, it wasn't overnight, but it was a good year, year and a half of playing the clubs, 2 years.
Yeah, but when you look at it in retrospect, it was pretty quick. Like, at the time, it might not have felt like it, but looking back now, like, really? They weren't around that long before they really broke huge.
And, you know, here's the thing. Slash and Steven, you know, they're veterans of the Sunset Strip. When they were 12 years old, they were going to the Rainbow, and they already knew Michael and, Mario. You know, they knew those guys growing up, and it was just natural for them to get into a band and do the routine. And the routine being get into a band, get popular enough to headline weekends at the Whiskey or the Troubadour. And what are some of the other clubs? The Roxy and the Old Man.
Oh, Gazzari's.
And Gazzari's.
Where do you remember when we went and saw Rockzilla at Gazzari's?
No.
We went...
Was Rockzilla a band?
They were a band. I don't know why we went, but we went to Gazzari's and Rockzilla was headlining. And the entire time I'm sitting there thinking, Jesus, Guns N' Roses played in this club like not 6-7 years ago. And here I am watching Rockzilla.
Are you sure I was there?
Yes. You took me to see Rockzilla.
I didn't take you specifically to see Rockzilla.
You took me to Gazzari's. Rockzilla happened to be... No, you... That was the only time I ever went to Gazzari's, and yeah, it was Rockzilla, and it was definitely with you, because nobody else I knew at the time would have gone to Gazzari's.
I could see that we went to the Rainbow, and then decided, hey, do you want to walk over to Gazzari's?
No, because I think you had tickets. I think somebody gave, I know you didn't buy them, but I think somebody gave you tickets to Rockzilla.
Well, how foolish do we look? I mean, Rockzilla is huge, and you know.
And who the hell are Guns N' Roses?
Right. Well... Who the hell are they now? You know, that's the sad thing. But anyway, so Appetite comes out. And this is what I want to get into was for those of you who are too young and weren't there to experience this onslaught of Guns N' Roses, it was pretty amazing. My first exposure, well, first of all, in July of 87, I remember going into Tower and seeing Appetite for Destruction in the new release crates in the front of the store. And I remember talking to a guy at Tower shortly thereafter. And the so-called band cover, the rape cover with the Robert Williams artwork, wasn't really banned. They did their first pressing and sent it out knowing that retail chains, you know, most of the retail chains weren't going to carry this thing. So all the employees of all these record stores knew that this first pressing of this album was an instant collector's item. So they snatched them up. It was basically, you know, an effort to produce an instant collector's item. You know, there was no naivete to, oh, we like this album cover. You know, they knew what they were doing. Just like with Live Like a Suicide, the EP that came out a few months before was actually financed by Geffen. They put it out on their own label, Uzi Suicide, to give them some street cred, but they were already signed, and Geffen said, look, let's get you, you know, a little bit of a established base, because, you know, we're going to release this thing. And, you know, they got reviews in Kerrang, and you know, so it did give them a wider exposure with that EP leading up to the release of Appetite.
So your first, so when you walked into Tower and saw Appetite, were you aware of them, or was that your first?
Was that your first
encounter?
I was aware of them somehow. You know, and by the way, the first albums that I saw were The Cross. You know, I never saw the Robert Williams artwork. That's why I bring up that point.
Right,
but. My next exposure to Guns N' Roses is that November, because I was always an avid reader, especially of BAM magazine. And where you could get BAM was Tower Records exclusively. I would get this magazine and read it cover to cover. You know, I'd be at Del Taco and I'd have BAM open. So anyway, November of 87, Guns N' Roses is the cover story, and they're out on tour, and it's a great read, you know, and it's funny. And it sort of endeared me to them a little bit. But I still didn't pick up appetite. My next exposure, I'm in New Jersey. My grandfather's sick. I'm helping to take care of him. I'm sort of stuck in this house. And my only pleasure, recreation, is watching Headbangers Ball on Saturdays and videotaping it. And this must have been maybe December of 87, the third hour of Headbangers Ball, I see Welcome to the Jungle for the first time. My first impression is, and by the way, you know, people say, oh, that's their glam look. That was not glam at all. Axl looked creepy to me. He looked like, he looked punk rock. I did not associate glam with him. I mean, he's skinny. He's got that tight white shirt. Even the hair did not ring glam rock to me. It rang punk rock, and his brow, he just looked evil. And when you intercut that with the newsreel footage, I thought, man, these guys are pretty hardcore. You know, they might be a little too dark for me. You know, I'm going to put on To Hell with the Devil by Stryper. And I was a huge Stryper fan, too. So that's my second exposure. And this is how it happens, you know. And obviously, they kept growing. I'm back in California. I hear Appetite for the first time. I'm over at my friend's, Rob Hargis. His best friend, Brian Monkey, which is funny because he resembled Steven Adler very much. I remember like a year later saying, you look like the drummer of Guns N' Roses. Unfortunately, he died in a motorcycle accident, this guy, Brian Monkey. But he was a dead ringer for Steven Adler of the Appetite era. Anyway, they're playing Appetite for Destruction. And I remember like being very impressed with the Sweet Child intro because that's the kind of guitar that I'm listening for. You know, again, I'm in the Shredder school. And then Rocket Queen comes on, and I remember Rob Hargis says, yeah, Axl fucked a groupie in the studio for this song. So there's already stories of their notoriety floating around. So that's my second exposure. Third exposure is when I'm with Rob's brother, Danny. He picks me up in his Mustang, and he's got Appetite playing, and he sees me listening. He's like, is Guns N' Roses too trendy for you? I'm like, no, I like it. You know, and I'm still sort of new to it all. But now it's growing on me. I get in his car. He's cranking Brownstone. I'm like, okay, this is pretty cool. And the bridge to Brownstone, you know, and the bridge to It's So Easy, which is sort of psychedelic. It's all starting to catch me now. And I'm loving it. And I have to say one more thing. I was in Moby Dick. I used to hang out with this guy named True Mason. And True was the son of Dave Mason, the famous rock star, mm-hmm. who did We Just Disagree. We used to go to shows at the country club, and we used to go to Moby Disc to buy used CDs. And I remember I was in Moby Disc, and this girl says to the clerk there, do you have Guns N' Roses? My boyfriend is in the band. And I said, oh, who's your boyfriend? And she goes, Izzy. And I go, oh, is he related to Lizzy? And I just made a goofy joke. I didn't know who Izzy was, but I was talking about Lizzy Borden, who I was a fan of at the time. And so just these little stupid things leading up to me finally getting the cassette at Music Plus, probably for $6.99. And I'm hooked. I love it. And so that was my initial exposure. I hope that wasn't boring for y'all, but it's just interesting how these things sort of evolve. And how about you tell us a little bit about your first exposure?
Yeah, my first exposure was secondhand through my older brother. So my brother's 5 years older than me. And so a lot of the music that I appreciated growing up was directly because of him. So I was into like AC/DC and Ozzy and Judas Priest and Maiden and particularly Motley Crue at a very young age. And so, and that was something my brother and I have always had a fairly contentious relationship, but you know, we bonded over music. We bonded over Star Wars and we bonded over music over the years. And so, you know, I was so much younger than him that I wasn't allowed to go to concerts. And so he would go see these bands in concert and then he would relay it all to me. He'd give me play-by-plays. And so it was, I think it was September of 86, and my parents went away for the weekend. And I went and stayed at a friend's house. And my brother, home alone, he's 17, and he takes the El Camino, that my takes my stepdad's El Camino, and we're living in Glendora at the time. This is a suburb of about 25 miles outside of Los Angeles, and him and his friends drive to downtown Los Angeles to an event called the LA Street Scene. And the LA Street Scene, it lasted a few days. It was like an open air festival, and then they had live bands playing. And so, they had a metal day. And I think Great White played that day, and I think Poison. And say what you will about Poison, they were, they were signed, they had a record deal, they had I think Look What the Cad Dragged. Poison was out by then. So it was actually a big deal for him to go see Poison. And I was just astounded that he went to downtown Los Angeles, because in 1986, I think downtown was kind of a pit. Like, it certainly isn't the hip, trendy place it is now. The place actually worked downtown. And, you know, 1986, for me, it was just this black pit on a map.
Right, and I hated, like, getting lost down there.
Oh, yeah, that was the only time we ever ended up downtown, is if we got lost on the way home from a Dodger game. So, but my brother, he, you know, took the El Camino and drove and went to the street scene and made it back alive. And so he was, you know, relaying this to me a few days later, and he said, oh, yeah, you know, we went, like, you know, Poison played. And I'm like, oh, really? And he goes, yeah, they were actually pretty good. And, you know, I was expecting the play-by-play of Poison, and I don't get it. Because he goes, yeah, but there was this other band that played called Guns N' Roses. Man, they sucked. But he went on and on about this band, and they went on, and they only played about a song and a half, and the lead singer was just the biggest asshole he'd ever seen, and the guy had the hair teased out, and there's like this lead guitarist with a Mott the Hoople hat kicking people in the front row, and people are booing, and they're throwing shit at them, and the lead
singer... Oh, that show.
That show.
I think I don't remember if Steven actually got smacked in the head with a Jack Daniels bottle, or if it missed him by an inch. That's a pretty big difference, but I remember him telling me about that, where the people were throwing...
It was brutal.
And he said that people were throwing shit, and then the band was spitting at the audience, and it was brutal.
It was brutal, and that, you know, this lead singer, you know, Axel, you know, tries to dive into the stage, and, like, security's grabbing him, throwing him back on the stage, and, yeah, they only played about a song and a half, and my brother, like, vividly remembered, you know, Axel grabbing the mic and saying, you guys fucked everything up, and we're not gonna play anymore for you, and you, and he points to some guy in the front row, fuck you, and they leave. And I still, to this day, I mean, this is almost 30 years later, I remember my brother kind of looking off and going, Guns N' Roses, man, they're going nowhere. And that was my introduction to Guns N' Roses.
How neat. And it's funny, because I've heard, you know, obviously being such a fan and talking to anybody remotely involved with Guns N' Roses, I mean, I was the guy that would recognize Josh Richman from the making of Don't Cry, and the woman that owned Scream from the Hard and Heavy video. And I'd see these people in Hollywood. Hey, I recognize you from this. And if I could, I'd ask them questions. But one of the things that I have heard from a lot of people was that there were a lot of naysayers, a lot of people that thought, they're not going anywhere. But who could have known? You know, when you watch those early, early shows from like 86 at the Roxy, I wouldn't have guessed that they would have been the biggest band. I mean, this is before they had Brownstone, It's So Easy, Sweet Child of Mine, you know, that really rounded out their repertoire. You know, they were doing Heartbreak Hotel and Jumpin' Jack Flash, fleshing it out. They had different versions of Welcome to the Jungle and Night Train, you know, early versions of that. So when you watch those early shows, the energy is there, absolutely. But if I had walked in on them, you know, at the Roxy or something and seen one, I probably would have been a skeptical asshole myself, yeah. You know?
But it did, even at the time, and I'm only 12 years old, I did think it was really interesting that my brother spent so much time talking about them.
Exactly.
And I brought that, because my brother ended up becoming a huge fan, you know, and I brought it up, you know, like a couple years later, like, oh, I thought it was so interesting that you, and he said, I must have known, like deep down, I must have known.
And yeah. I have to go off topic here real quick. I was in a band called Flesh Gods, and we played at DiPiazza's. We were opening up for Mike Watt and Stephen Perkins of Jane's Addiction. And a band opened for us, and they had sort of a decent audience. Well, anyway, we went on and played, and I guess the following week or so, somebody alerts me to this little blog on the internet. And this girl writes, we went and saw, you know, so-and-so's band. They were great. But then, hold on to your hats, next was Flesh Gods. And she spent, I don't know, at least 1,200 words bashing us. So her friend's band was great. That's it. Here's 1,200 words on Flesh Gods. You know, the lead singer wore aviator sunglasses, even though it was dark. But when he took them off, we were like, oh, please put them back on. So it was pretty funny. But she gave us 1,200 words. Her buddy's band, what could she say? She didn't say anything. So, and I'm not at all comparing myself to Guns N' Roses, but that is sort of the dynamic, like, of a band irks you so much that you can't stop talking about them. There's something there.
So that was September of 86, and my next encounter with them was, I think, around, honestly, maybe February or March of 87, and they were actually on the cover of Hip Parader.
Oh, wow.
Which was amazing because the only time I'd heard of them was, you know, through my brother's experience. So it was this cover of Hip Parader, and it was, you know, the new generation of metal. And the cover was broken up into four sections. And so there was Cinderella, Megadeth, Striper, and Guns N' Roses. And I think the other three, I think, already had albums out. Like, I knew, you know, I had Megadeth's albums and Cinderella's albums, and, you know, Striper was, you know, already established. And there was Guns N' Roses. I thought, what the hell are these guys doing? This is the first time I'm seeing them. And this is, you know, Axl has, you know, if I'm remembering right, he has the teased hair, and he's wearing leather pants that looks like he took a bottle of white out and wrote "Glam sucks" on the pants. And I, you know, I don't know if I'm 100% sure, but I think on the inside there was a picture of Slash. So this is my first exposure, like, to this guy with, you know, with the hair, and his name is Slash. I'm thinking, what the hell is this? And I think the caption under the photo is, "I hate CeCe DeVille's guts." So this is my first, like, thinking, who the hell are these bozos?
Yeah, they really played out that feud with Poison in the press early on. Like, that was...
And I'm thinking, well, Poison has an album. Like, who the hell are these guys? So that was my second impression. And then, so, you know, I grew up here in Los Angeles, and we had KNAC, which was, you know, the ultimate metal station. And so the first time I ever heard them, I think, was Brownstone. And if I'm not mistaken, I think KNAC was playing Brownstone and Jungle prior to the album actually coming out. And so, you know, I heard Brownstone and I liked it, didn't know it was them. And I heard Welcome to the Jungle, and that I knew it was them. And I thought it was okay. You know, and I was talking to my brother, I'm like, "Hey, have you heard that Welcome to the Jungle song? That's that shitty band you saw at the street scene." And he goes, Yeah, that Mr. Brownstone song is them too. And I said, "No, it's not." And he said, "Yeah, it is." I said, No. And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Wow, so they have different, they're like Kiss, they have different guys in the band singing." He goes, "No, that's the same guy." And that blew me away that was the same guy singing on both songs.
Right. Like, when Patience came out, so many people that I knew didn't think that was Axl singing. Yeah.
Like, it was amazing that he was so versatile. And so, and KNAC, like, played these two songs over and over. And so that's how I started to really become familiar with them. And I remember reading about them in the LA Times about the Robert Williams cover. And so I remember gradually becoming more and more aware. And when I finally, and I wanted to buy the album, and it was actually before the album was even released. So I was that aware of them before Appetite even came out. And so when it finally came out, I remember I went to a Tower Records in Buena Park, and they were sold out. Which, in retrospect, they probably ordered like two copies. But at the time, I'm like, "Oh my God, it was sold out." So my brother finally got a copy of the cassette, and by this time he was living in Orange County, and I was still in Glendora. And he was working a lot. He had graduated, and so he was working so much that he just lent me his Appetite cassette. And I don't think it's ever taken me so long to get through an entire album, because every song I loved so much, I listened to it over and over and over, and it took forever to get through the whole album just because I loved every song.
Wow, especially on a cassette.
Yeah, it was a pain. Well, so that was like I would listen to, you know, like, once I discovered Brownstone and I liked Paradise City, I would just stick with those two because I really didn't want to rewind it to listen to Welcome to the Jungle. And I will never forget the first time I heard Sweet Child of Mine. I was just in my room, just cleaning my room or putting around. And that guitar riff comes on. And I dropped to my knees and just sat there stunned. Listen, I just laid my head down on the bed and just listened to that song.
Wow.
And I don't think I've ever been so affected by a song in my entire life. And that was it. Like, I was absolutely sunk. And you know, this is probably October, November of 1987. Nobody knows who they are, at least not, you know, at Sandberg Junior High in Glendora. So here is this band that I legitimately loved, and nobody knew who they were, and it was the coolest thing in the world.
Wow, that is cool, to be into something before it's huge.
When it got huge, I was so pissed. But by that time, I was so invested in them that I couldn't just toss them aside because they'd gotten so big.
Right. And it's interesting because in November of 87, if I'm not mistaken, they did Headbangers Ball.
Is that when they trashed the set?
Right.
With that's, was that guy's name Smash?
Yeah, Smash. So it was Smash and Slash. Smash and
Slash.
And I don't know if they didn't really do a very good job of trashing it, but it was Smash's last episode before, I guess, Adam Carey came on.
Was that his last episode?
I think so. That's who was like, come on, guys, you know, wreck this place.
It's funny. And even then, like, I remember just thinking, what a bunch of bozos. But I loved the music with thinking, oh, God.
But I'll tell you what, that's the coolest I've ever seen Izzy. First of all, that might be some of the only bits of video where he's actually talking, with the exception of maybe some Rock and Rio interviews. But Izzy's pretty damn cool in that. And it's funny for me to say that because early on, you know, in 88 and 89, when my girlfriend and I bonded over Guns N' Roses, we always thought, they got to get rid of Izzy. He doesn't belong. I didn't get it at the time. Here's the thing. I didn't get it at the time. I'm still coming from the shredder school. Steve's got the hair. Axel's got the look. Somehow for me, Izzy had the shorter hair. It didn't fit in, but I get it now. And this is what, like, Gilby, I don't think, gets it. You know, when Gilby came into the band, it was like another Slash. In fact, it was like a more polished Slash. What Izzy brought to the band was this totally off-the-wall counterpoint. He had this tone, you know, sort of dirty, sort of clean, but it sounded like it was coming from a junky amp. You know, there was nothing professional about it, but his playing, his little rhythmic nuances, you know, when I want to tell somebody what made Izzy special, I tell them to listen to Knock It on Heaven's Door from the Ritz. When they have that break, and, you know, and just before Axel's about to address the audience, and by the way, I don't think Bob Dylan ever expected Knock It on Heaven's Door to be a sing-along, but but just before that, you hear Izzy just riffing, you know, around the chords, you know, G, C, D. But what Izzy's doing, he's noodling around the chords. He's doing these little off-kilter riffs. And it's really something. It's not your straight-ahead power chord crunch. You know, when Gilby gets in there, he's doing like some reggae-type rhythmic thing, or, you know, or he's doing arpeggiated chords. And you listen to the studio version of Knocking on Heaven's Door, and those verses just die because it's just Slash. Izzy's not on it. And it's like, I mean, it's still a great song, and I still love it. I love the Days of Thunder version. But Izzy really filled out that sound. He really rounded it out. And I don't think Gilby actually listened to Izzy's parts. You know, I think he just sort of followed Slash, and that's what we ended up with. Nothing against Gilby. He's a great guy.
But I think I remember Gilby once saying, only God and Izzy knows what he's doing on those songs.
Hi, exactly.
You know, and I used to just, like, at night when I was, like, half asleep, I would put on Appetite and put on my headphones, and that's how I just listen for Izzy. Like, but I had to be just in this utter, like, clear state of mind to listen that close and to hear what he was doing, and was always just amazed.
Yeah, totally.
So he just really laid the, he was kind of a backbone, but you didn't know it.
Yeah, and in, you know, 88, 89, I didn't realize that. You know, I didn't realize just how special Izzy was and how much he really contributed. And obviously he wrote the riff to Brownstone and contributed a whole lot to the songwriting. But it's getting late here in North Hollywood, and we should probably wrap it up until next time.
Yes. This has been fun.
Yeah, it's been great.
I feel giddy. I talk about Guns N' Roses. I haven't talked about Guns N' Roses like this for a very long time. So thank you for allowing me to.
Sure. And I don't know how this is going to go over. It's just,
I have no idea.
It's just a goofy little passion project, an idea that I came up with a couple months ago when I, you know, I didn't remember your last name. And all I remembered was your eBay name, Mr. Brownstone.
My brother uses that account. I haven't used that account in 15 years.
Right, and that's how I contacted you to do this. And it's been a fun reunion.
Yeah, absolutely.
And hopefully we'll be back next month with a new episode.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, well, have a good night, Christina.
You too, Brett.
See you guys.
Original music produced by Brooke Ellis. All Jungle Natives content, all rights reserved.